Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. For your free 30-day trial of Mubi, go to mubi.com/filmstage. Back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast, thefilmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me today to talk about the new film 3 months ago by Mike Mills, 20th Century Women, we have Michael Snydell.
Hello.
Hello. We also have benevolent Lord Master Jordan Raup.
Hello.
Hello. Bill is not here today. Because of scheduling conflicts, it'll be the three of us to talk about 20th Century Women, a movie that Michael Snydell placed on his top 10 of 2016 list. I think it was
number five, said, I believe.
Number five.
And Jordan did as well.
No, what number was it for you?
I believe three or four.
And this was one of the films that I was most upset to not be able to see before making my top 10 list. And just in general, because as we've talked about many times on this podcast, sometimes it's just weirdly impossible to know when a limited release movie is coming out. It's a real kick in the nads. So we're going to talk about it today because we didn't feel like talking about what else came out. It was like The Case for Christ and The Smurfs.
And the Going in Style remake directed by Zach Braff.
Man.
I half wish that we had just decided to do that because
I feel like that would be a 10-minute conversation if that.
Just you guys just want to get blocked by Zach Braff, huh? It's pretty
Zach
easy,
Braff
I've heard.
Retrospective. Man, he hit at a very specific cultural moment, and I don't think that moment lasted longer than it took us to all become very tired of him. So, anyway, we'll be talking about...
I think the Shins did a lot of the heavy lifting there, too, if we're being honest.
That's a very good point. looking back on that movie, it's kind of like, well, I really feel like that's a soundtrack film. And
sure.
I don't think it has much beyond that. But anyway, here we are today to talk about 20th Century Women, which is now available on VOD. So we decided this would be a good time to skip back and take a look at it and give it the conversation that we wish we'd been able to give it previously. Before we get into that, though, let me remind everyone, you can follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. Search for us on Facebook, The Film Stage Show. Give us a comment and a rating on iTunes. And, of course, email us podcast@thefilmstage.com. Our last podcast got a very strong reaction on Twitter and Facebook, with numerous people chiming in to say that they agreed with me that you can't have ghosts without an actor.
Can we move on?
No, we can't, because I want everyone to know that there was not a single person who wrote in that did not agree with me. So, thank you.
Cool, so it's the internet is what you're saying.
Yes, thank you, our listeners, for making me feel a little less insane. Anyway, now that I've rubbed my victory in the face of all, let's talk about Mubi, who is bringing you today's episode. Mubi is a streaming online service unlike any other, because instead of just grabbing up a library of nonsense and tossing it at you, Mubi takes the time to actually curate their films, releases one at a time, that's one film per day, and then gives you 30 days to watch, so you constantly have a rotating series of 30 great films for you to enjoy. Where can you enjoy it? You can enjoy it on your streaming device, like a tablet or a phone, or you can use their handy Roku app, which, as I've said in the past, is one of the best designed streaming cinema, just basic streaming apps on Earth, because, dear God, Netflix and Amazon, I don't even know how to describe how terrible the interfaces on those are. So Mubi, by streamlining their selection and actually taking time to make sure they're presenting these things in the most beautiful way possible, has created perhaps the best streaming app, in addition to having one of the most interesting and diverse streaming libraries. And you can also download their movies to your mobile device. So if you, like me, are going to be going on a vacation soon and are unsure of the Wi-Fi fidelity, you will be covered. They have a bunch of great stuff coming out. I wanted to highlight Sarah Winchester, Phantom of the Opera. It's part of this month's Special Discovery Duo. And this film is a gorgeous, mysterious sketch towards dark opera, rich in dance and music, which I was going to say if you know me, but oddly enough, you may not even know this about me if you think you know me, are two things that I am very interested in. Jordan Raup, you had something else you wanted to highlight, did you not?
Sure. Yeah, well, it should also be said that the film you recommended is also directed by Bertrand Bonello, who has one of the best films of last year that'll finally come out this year, Nocturama. So, released by actually Nick Newman's company, Grasshopper, along with Netflix later this year. But if you want a little refresher on Bonello, it's a good one. So anyways, yeah, my pick was Tony Conrad, Completely in the Present. So this is based on the avant-garde artist Tony Conrad, which I actually know a little bit better than I would say most people, because he actually taught at my college, University at Buffalo. So he was definitely a character there. He was, you know, very in his own world all the time, which was part of his charm. And if you guys don't know about him, one of his claim to fame is that he was like indirectly responsible for the formation of, or the Velvet Underground, how they got their name, which is kind of interesting. They were all at his apartment in the Lower East Side, and he had a book called The Velvet Underground, and that's how they found the name. So, he was very involved.
Was that about like the rock scene in Hungary?
It was BDSM, I thought.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it was. Yes.
Not about BDSM. It was about...
It is about BDSM.
Oh, really? Goddamn.
Yes. Something. Yeah.
Boom.
Good job, Michael.
I thought it was about the Velvet Revolution, which was the nonviolent transition of power in what was then Czechoslovakia.
Oh, damn. You're actually talking about something real. Never mind.
Anyways,
Stoppard's Rock and Roll is a fantastic play about that thing. So anyway.
All right, Brian.
But he did much more than that. He made a lot of albums. He was like really a pioneer in like the drone music scene and different types of filmmaking. So anyways, he had a really fascinating career, and he unfortunately passed away last year. So this is a documentary that honors him, and after getting like a small limited release, it's now on Mubi for the next 30 days. So check it out.
All right.
Cool.
Also, for anyone who's interested, Mubi has their first major theatrical release in the U.S., The Happiest Day in the Life of Ali Maki, and that is opening in New York and L.A. in 2 weeks. Well, yeah, 2 weeks, April 21st. April 21st.
Michael actually reviewed that.
Yes, it's a good one.
Sweet. All right. So, I guess I should tell people how they can get a 30-day trial. All you have to do is go to mubi.com/filmstage, and you will be able to try out Mubi for 30 days on us. So do that, check it out, and understand why Mubi is a cut above all the other streaming services. All right. Gentlemen, any other housekeeping things you want to say before we jump into 20th Century Women?
No.
I don't think so.
Well, that extended. You could just say no. You don't have to say silent for 20 seconds. Anyway, here we go. Here is the trailer for 20th Century Women.
Stop.
What?
Thinking that you know everything that's going on.
No, I don't. I just think that, you know, having your heart broken is a tremendous way to learn about the world.
I see the shapes. I remember thumb maps. I see the shore.
This is the really hard part. And then it gets better. And then it gets hard again.
Do you think you're happy?
All right. That is the trailer for 20th Century Women, the newest film from director Mike Mills, who you've probably heard me talk a lot about on this podcast, because I can't go 6 months without bringing up and or watching Beginners again. So this film is about a... I don't know who the protagonist is. I'm going to say that it's Annette Bening. Annette Bening is a single mother who runs a boarding house and has a 16, 15-year-old son who, in the year 1979 are struggling with life, love, and everything in between. It's an expansive film with a great cast and a lot on its mind. Let's see how it did. Jordan Raup, our benevolent Lord and Master, since you were the guest, why don't you kick us off?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, so I think with, you know, Mike Mills, him, he's only made a few films thus far, and I think if you kind of read like the log line of any of his films, they kind of seem like they could fall into this kind of indie cliche kind of insufferable category. And then when you watch them, I think he brings so much personality, and they just kind of all feel kind of like they're this emotionally disarming quality through his use of montage, and that seems so hyper specific that you can't help but just kind of fall in love with it. And I think someone described this film as kind of like being hugged for 2 hours, and that's kind of how you kind of feel. I think a big quality of that is not only the performances, but there's a specific track. Roger Neal did the score, and there's a track, you know, just called Santa Barbara 1979, and it opens the film and it plays throughout, and it just there's like this warm feeling to it that fits perfectly with, you know, what Mike Mills is conveying here. And you know, it's just nice to see a movie with, you know, these characters who, you know, he really fleshes each of them out. They each get their own kind of montage section, which kind of helps build up their backstory. And I mean, spoilers for this film seem silly, but I will say there is kind of this all-encompassing view on life, you know, where these characters talk about, you know, past the point of this time period and where their life will head. And I think it makes for a really just dramatically compelling and emotional kind of journey that another, you know, indie director taking on the same, if they got the script for this, I don't know if they would have handled it in the same way as Mike Mills. He just brings such a, you know, distinct, you know, visual style, and just his direction, I think, is perfect for this. I saw this and, you know, immediately loved it. I will say, I've never in my entire life, you know, I've seen so many movies, I've never once immediately wanted to call my mom right after a movie. And I did that with this. And so that's a testament to how much I loved it. And we can dive more into it. But yeah, I'm a huge fan of this one.
Yeah, I've never wanted to call my mom after a movie. I did call my dad after The Tree of Life. I don't know precisely what that says, but interesting. Interesting reaction. All right, Michael Snydell.
Yeah, to piggyback on what Jordan was saying, like Mills, again, like I absolutely understand when people don't like him, like even beyond, you know, the idea that his films are kind of, the log lines are just filled with indie cliches. It's just, I think there's a certain sense that it, even as it is hyper-specific, that there's points where the character's affectations sometimes stand in for personality and things like that. And I think his past two films, Thumbsucker especially, I think was the weakest. And I like Beginners a lot. But I mention that because I feel like 20th Century Woman is kind of a rebuke to his previous career in the sense that it is, you know, trying to tell these grandiose, histories of these characters, but it's also, it's not a collection of tics. Everything that's in here, in relating to the setting and related to what these characters are interested in and their passions, they shape the current moment and their future. Like, for example, like there is like a lot of conversations about like second wave feminism in here and like proto punk and like the rise of, you know, things like Germs and Black Flag, and like, and those are small parts of the movie, but they also like deeply inform how these characters evolve. And what I like so much about this movie is that the movie doesn't feel like it is, it finds a balance between not deifying, you know, the mother character or, you know, Annette Bening's character or Greta Gerwig's character or Elle Fanning's character. And they could all stand in for, you know, a mother figure, you know, an aunt, you know, the cool aunt figure, that first love or first crush. Like, they're all very specific archetypes,
but the movie isn't ever trying to define them, and even like vocally steps back when it seems like these characters have almost been like when everything's been said about them. It steps back at that moment within the movie and says, no, there's so much more to these people. Don't pretend like you know them. And that's something that I don't see a lot, especially in coming of age films. And it was really amazing to come away from this film and say, I have such a great sense of these people, but there's so much more to them. And they can't be diminished to, again, like a collection of tics or interests or moments. And said, yeah, I think the writing at times is a little bit I've seen it twice, and the second time I thought the writing was a little less spontaneous than the first time. And I think that the third act especially has some oddness in pacing, but we'll talk about this. But yeah, I just think this is a really strong film, and it kind of puts a lot of coming of age films to shame by being able to keep all of these stories in focus and give them the time they need.
Okay. So let's journey back to 2005 for a moment. There were two films that came out that year. I guess I was either still in high school or just entering college to date myself. And I could never tell the difference between them, and I never saw either of them. One of them was called The Chum Scrubber, and the other was called The Thumb Sucker. And apparently Mike Mills directed Thumb Sucker. I have not seen that. I should probably go back. But the two films are locked in my head so much that I can't remember what either one of them is about. That's just a funny story about apparently my way that my head works, that those two films are just forever entwined in my head. So if during the course of my life I ever say that Mike Mills directed The Chum Scrubber, know that I mean The Thumb Sucker, and I apologize. Anyway, when I was first a fledgling film critic and standing in line with GoFobo tickets, hoping to be let in to an early screening so that I could write my review of something before it came out, I went and saw Beginners, a film that I knew nothing about, and I basically left the theater crying, and have since that day used Beginners along with The Leftovers, the HBO show, as a kind of emotional purging mechanism. So that if ever I feel as though I am doing my Irish thing where I pent up too many emotions, I will throw one of those on and just let the mastery of those stories rip the emotions out of me and into the world. So Beginners is definitely one of, if not the top of, my favorite films of the last decade, because it came out in 2010. Does that count, or is that last decade?
That would be this decade, 2010.
Okay. Just making sure,
yeah,
that it wasn't one of those things where it was like 2000 to 2009. Anyway, so yeah, I have a great affinity for that. I was super excited for this film. I'm not that high on it. I think that there's a lot of good things within this film, and I think that a lot of moments in it really hit true. But I think, you know, coming off of Beginners, which I had, I didn't even need to rewatch because I could basically play the whole film in my head. But that film, even though it goes through three, possibly three and a half people's stories in order to tell a very, not concise, but a very focused tale of grief and loss and uncertainty and unhappiness and depression and people not quite understanding who they are until later in life and thus having to begin to live a true life at varying stages, that was such a focused theme, if not a focused story, that for this movie to be as expansive and kind of scattershot as it is was a bit of a disappointment. And I feel like I'm having trouble just surmounting that disappointment to really focus on all the things that worked. So if my thoughts come off as a little disconnected and unmoored, it's because I just watched this the other day and I'm still kind of struggling with my feelings over it. I will say Annette Bening not being given the Oscar for Best Actress, let alone nominated, is incomprehensible to me. And I don't feel like I have to have seen Florence Foster Jenkins to know that she could have at least been given that particular spot. Elle Fanning, likewise, is great in a role that I think could have gone awry in many places, but instead was grounded and fully realized. I love me some Billy Crudup, so it's always good to see him in a film.
There's someone you haven't mentioned, Brian.
Yeah, Lucas Jade Zimmern, who plays Jamie, is likewise very good. And again, a role that could be seen as insufferable. You know, he's a young man who's trying to find his place in the world and is kind of rebelling against his mother, which is weird because she doesn't seem to have any strictures that he would really need to rebel against. So he's more or less just kind of existentially testing his boundaries, which...
Like every teenager.
Yeah, it's just weird because, like, I know that, like, when I was a teenager, it was like, you can't be out past 10 o'clock. And so, like, around 11 p.m., I would, like, sneak out of my house because that's a stricture that I needed to buck against. But this kid, his mom is just like, so what's going on with you? Just tell me how you are. And he's like, whatever, mom, you don't know, I'm going to leave. And it's just like, man, that's just like the thinnest pretense for rebellion. But you know, when you're a teen, you got to rebel in any way you can. And so, like I said, it's a person who I don't quite get, but I think that his performance and of course, Mike Mills' writing and directing helped to modulate that in a way that made it seem like it still made sense because he is a young man who is still technically under the thumb and the control of his mother, though she is again, one of the most permissive women that I have ever known. I don't know, Mike, who else do I have to talk about?
just get into it. Come on.
I just don't like Greta Gerwig, guys. I think that that's what I've got to deal with right now. It's taken
10 films, but finally you've come to the realization.
The thing is, you know, if you like someone in one film, you're willing to give them a lot of leeway and begin to think, like, maybe they're just making bad choices. Like, Naomi Watts. Like, I love Naomi Watts. When was the last time she was in a good film? I don't even know.
Mulholland Drive.
I was going to say, maybe Mulholland Drive. Was that before or after the remake of Funny Games?
I think that was before, wasn't it?
Funny Games was after.
Okay, yeah. So she was good in Funny Games. I mean, like, there we go. Like, I can find things, but, like, man, like, aside from her tiny, tiny role in Jackie, like...
Well, Eastern Promises.
Oh, I was back on Greta Gerwig. But yes, Naomi Watts, Eastern Promises, great. Also, I'm looking forward to her... looking forward to her work in Book of Henry.
Because, not for the same reasons, though, probably.
No. No, I'm not. Find me another human male.
Oh, and she's in Twin... Isn't she in Twin Peaks? She's in Twin Peaks, so there you go.
Yeah, but I haven't seen that yet.
I know.
That doesn't count. So, I mean, I guess I liked Greta Gerwig in The House of the Devil, and Greenberg, and scrolling up.
Did you see Damsels in Distress?
Yeah, I did not like that movie.
Mistress America.
I didn't see that one.
I know you guys didn't love Edith, but she's barely in it. But
yeah,
that was a great.
So I guess Jackie, her little part in Jackie. But even in Jackie, I was like, God damn it, that's Greta Gerwig. Like, there's just something, very, like, knowing about her. Like, I don't like the way that she plays her characters. There's a scene in this movie where she's about to hook up with someone and then does this whole thing where she's like, tell me a story, like, pretend that you're a photographer and I'm a model and you can't stop touching me and you keep, like, saying you're sorry. And I was like, God damn it, Greta Gerwig, stop it. Like, I just can't. I can't handle it.
And can I read a one-sentence thing you will love, Brian?
Yeah.
So this is from Letterboxd. Greta didn't write this, so I wasn't sure if I was going to get the full Gerwig experience, but as soon as she said she was going to be late on rent, I knew I was in the clear.
Oh my God. Yeah, I just like, it's just her delivery. It's just the way that she like creates the person who would say those words. Because I feel like if Elle Fanning had that particular role, she could sell that moment. But Greta Gerwig isn't like, this is a woman who is broken in a certain way and wants this or needs this, or even this is a person who just knows what she likes. Greta Gerwig's like, oh, this is a total Gerwig moment. I'm going to Gerwig out on this. And I can't.
I think that's just her, though.
But then
I thought, I don't get a sense she's like straining or like adding a sense of not inauthenticity. I don't think there's a fraudulence to when she does those things, like that scene with Billy Crudup in the bedroom.
I don't know. I feel like there's a lack of truth to that moment for me. It just, like I said, it just feels like it's a Gerwig moment.
I found like the scenes, you know, where she is talking about like, you know, the medical issue she's having really touching. But I will say the scenes where it's, you know, like the punk rock versus, you know, Talking Heads and things like that, where there is a kind of a, that's where the film does fall into, I think, like an indie cliche moment where it's, you know, trying to talk about, you know, one superior than the other. And just, it seems a little silly.
For instance, and this is one of the things that the film does well, is she has a moment where she's talking about the raincoats with Annette Bening's character, Dorothea. And she's talking about it, and I'm just like, God damn it, Greta Gerwig. I was just like, but she didn't write this. Like, this is just how she's acting. I don't understand why I'm focusing so much on her. But then when Annette Bening and Billy Crudup have their little record moment, it's not even that his explanations are better or he feels more true. It's just the energy in that scene where he's playing Black Flag for Annette Bening. And she like clearly doesn't get it in the same way that she didn't get the raincoats. And then she says, like, okay, can you play me the Art Fag one? And then Billy Crudup's like, all right, yeah, here's the Art Fags. And it's just, there's something about the energy and the feeling between them that it feels a lot more real and natural. And a lot of times when Greta Gerwig wasn't dealing with her personal issues, when she was just expounding upon something, it felt a lot more false and a lot more written. And in Beginners, there was never a false moment, despite, you know, a lot of really false things, like a lot of clearly indie movie constructions.
Yeah, I really disagree with that one.
You really what?
I really disagree with that. I really like Beginners. I think I love Melanie Laurent. I like Ewan McGregor. I think a lot of things they say and the way that like Melanie Laurent's character just kind of like, she is pushed into a box that makes me very uncomfortable in terms of how she has to act, as like very much like, it's the exact opposite of what we talked about with Kristen Stewart yesterday. Or I'm sorry, not yesterday, last week. It feels like yesterday. Last week in Personal Shopper. last week in Personal Shopper. Like I consider Melanie Laurent's role and character like at the exact opposite of that spectrum. And that's why like, I do kind of, to bring it back to this, I don't want to compare Greta Gerwig and Kristen Stewart, but like at the same time, I do think there is a similar set of rawness manifested in entirely different ways to them. Like I see what you're talking about, but I guess it's just weird for me that you're saying that feels untrue, because it feels, I think it feels true. You just don't like how it feels true. Like I've known people like that.
I guess that's possible.
Where I haven't known people like Melanie Laurent's character in Beginners. Like that is something to me that felt like untrue and felt like a fantasy.
Interesting. You make a valid point, because it is possible. Sorry, I'm losing my voice apparently. It is possible that when I say untrue, I just mean deeply unpleasant to me. I will take us briefly back to the Queen of Earth episode that we recorded, where Nick Newman and I basically got in a screaming match with each other. The kind of heated film discussion you can only find on the Film Stage Show, where I said, these people don't act like real people. What the hell is going on here? Everything is a construction just to create another dumb scene. And Nick Newman said, I know people like this. This is how people act. And I, like, rebelled at the thought. And then you saying now about Greta Gerwig that it's something that's true, but that maybe I just don't like. It's possible. It is very possible that there are people out there who act like this, and I have actively avoided them or cut them out of my life because I find those people insufferable. So it's possible that she is portraying a real person who I, in reality, would look at and say, I can't be around this person because they feel like a construct that I don't need in my life. It's possible. I can't define if she is a bad actress or just an actress who I do not enjoy.
The true test will be this year. She directed her own solo, her first solo feature. So yeah, can't wait for that review.
The funny thing is that I think that maybe she would be better directing herself because she wouldn't be pigeonholed in the way that these other directors who are men happen to see her.
Unfortunately, she does not star in the movie.
What was that?
She does not star in the film.
Well, that sucks. I don't know. Ronan, I just don't know what to say. I will say that, you know, I don't think she's a bad actress. I think that deployed well, she can do good work, but I just happen not to like her most times, which doesn't mean
she's a big part of this movie, so I can see why a good portion of this movie then would get stuck in your craw.
Yeah, but it's funny because, like Jordan was saying, all of her things with her medical diagnosis, like, I think that things like that strip away the, you know, when you see a person in distress, you're seeing a more raw, realistic version of them. You know, when I'm at work and I'm talking to someone, or when I'm at a party and I'm talking to someone, rarely am I my full true self. But, like, if you were to give me a tragedy that sandblasted away the layers of societal niceness that I have to put up in order to be able to live in this world, you would be seeing a more valid version of myself. And so when the movie gives her moments like that, it's quite powerful. The scene with her and her character is Abby and Jamie after a doctor's appointment are really fantastic. I think a lot of her moments with him when she's, like, trying to teach him about love and life are super interesting. There's just instances, like, at the dinner table, I won't get into it because it's sort of a climactic moment, but, you know, her actions there just struck me as really hollow and untrue, and, or again, just, I wouldn't want to be in there, and I don't like her for doing it, so... But I do feel like there are other actresses who, if in that role, might have done something different that I would have found to be more acceptable in that way. It's very hard for me to dictate precisely what my issue is with her. But my greater issue with the film, and the thing that would hold it back from being my top 10 of last year, or putting it within sight of Beginners, is just the fact that, like I said, Beginners was such a singular emotional tone, played so perfectly, and it was such an interesting look at varying different styles of grieving and searching for understanding in your own self, that for this one to be a little more open, a little less focused, was a bit of a disappointment for me. And I think that perhaps having seen it now and knowing what it is, were I to see it again, I would like it more. But as for my off-the-cuff thoughts, it's still a fine movie, but it's not what I had been hoping for.
That's fair. Yeah. do you want to, I mean, we can talk a little bit. Do you want to, like, I mean, we can open it up for spoilers, I guess, even though it's not really a spoiler heavy movie. Sure. There's no twist, but
it's not quite a spoilery movie, but I think to talk about some of the moments and get into the ideas expressed would require that. So that's our basic thoughts on this. It's in two top tens of the year for my esteemed associates. And for me, it's worth seeking out, especially, you know, if you're a fan of Mike Mills. But I unfortunately, I guess I'm just, you know, if, like, you have a really great meal and then you go back and the meal is just not quite as good as you remembered, or, like, maybe there was a different chef and so the pieces are still there, but it doesn't come together as fully. Like, that's
Thank
sort
you, Brian.
Of what I'm dealing with.
It's been a few episodes, now, so now we're overdue.
Now I get what you're trying to say. I didn't before.
I honestly don't know if the food metaphors help or not, but
Sometimes they're genius. Other times they're that one.
That one's not okay. I'll say that is not genius. You know, it's not my, what was it? A mayonnaise sandwich on white bread that nearly made Amanda vomit on Mike. But
oh,
yes.
God. Yeah.
Anyway, so now that the obligatory food metaphor is gone, let's talk about spoilers, quote unquote, for 20th Century Women.
Brett, I kind of want to talk more about, like, I go back and forth on whether I think this film is unfocused and scattershot or on purpose, or whether it's a problem with the film. Like, I think the third act, like the last 35 minutes, is kind of meanders in a way I don't particularly like. But I do think that openness is what potentially makes me think this is so much better than his other films as a whole. Like, just a sense that this film will not be pinned down. Like, and it is very tight in the sense that it, you know, keeps passing the baton between these narrators and tells a good amount of each one of their stories in, like, a very rigid way, but that also seems by design to be, there's so much left. So, like, I do find the question of whether this is unfocused, like, really interesting. And you're not the only one who's voiced this opinion. I've seen a lot of reviews that are a little bit more mixed voicing that exact thing, saying that, you know, this was, you know, trying to be a jack of all trades and ends up, you know, being a master of none, like that type of sentiment. So I guess to go into specifics, are there specific things besides everything with Greta Gerwig not involving her health? Like, are there specific things that feel out of place to you? Like, I guess I just want to get into this a little bit.
I mean, it's hard for me to say, because as a picture of a life, nothing feels entirely out of place. You know, there's a lot of discussion about music, and I don't think it's one of those things where, like, to the story that this movie's trying to tell, it's not 100% necessary to get into as many specifics as they do, but I like that they do, because it makes it feel more real. But really, it sort of does come down to, like, maybe there's just too many people and we're telling too much of all of their story. It's novelistic, but in a novel you could have, like, 1,000 pages and give everyone 200 of them. But, you know, we get Billy Crudup's William, who fixes cars but seems to really love pottery. But we kind of only hear about pottery twice, and it never quite becomes an aspect of his character. He makes his own shampoo, which is just something that I had to hear and deal with. So, I mean, these are specifics of a character that make that character feel more real, but at the same time, it's sort of like, but if this is a story about Annette Bening and her relationship with her son and his relationship with her, you know, why are we spending so much time on the tale of Abby's, you know, departure from Santa Barbara, going to New York, and then coming back and having to deal with all of her things? Why are we listening to Billy Crudup's first failed marriage and his time at a commune? You know,
but it's not really only about that relationship. I think that's a little disingenuous to say that's what the film is trying to make the focus. It's how these three women specifically influence him. And I mean, Billy Crudup, like, they even say early on that he was a part of our life for a very short time.
Yeah.
But, like, that was the, you know, epical. Is that the word I'm looking for?
Yeah.
That was the, yeah. I probably mispronounced that. That was the moment. Like, and that's why he needed to be there. I mean, I kind of like how there was such an ephemerality to his character, and the sense that we do just get, you know, that he's doing pottery and having, you know, where he's just extremely charismatic and handsome. Yeah. And is able to just, you know, be with all of these women, but not in a way that feels
gross. Like it's very interesting how there's like, you know, this underlying sadness to him, but that's not what that's about at all. It's just a sense that like this is a person who was kind of out of time and like didn't necessarily make mistakes, but his road has not in any way been it's not been a traditional arc in any way, in the sense of, you know, he was married previously, he was in a commune, and now he's a mechanic. Like, you know, like it's just so it can just swerve in so many directions. And I feel like that's reflective of the whole movie, in the sense of like Greta Gerwig is another character. I'm sorry, I don't have her name in front of me.
Gerwig is Abby.
Abby like is another character who thought she had it figured out and thought she maybe found like true love with it's a professor, is that right?
It was a teacher of some kind.
Teacher.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Like, and she thought like all of these characters, it just continually keeps muddying the waters of who they are and what they went through. And like you see that through three different generations.
Right, but
refracted.
I get that, and I like it, but I think that, you know, the thing that kind of came through for me the most in the film, the thread that kept pulling me back into it was Annette Bening, and her, you know, she was born during the Depression, and you know she's a very modern woman. She is like cool with her son going out and getting drunk. She has all these people in her house. She's accepting, and she invites everyone over for dinner, which is kind of fun because she enjoys a sense of community. And like that scene where she's like getting a light from, I guess he's the bouncer or the ticket taker at this club, and just says like, Abby has your number, like I'll have her invite you over for dinner. And he's like, oh, cool, yeah, I'd like that. And then he's at a later dinner scene. It's fun. Her, and she goes up to Abby and says like, show me this modern world. Because like her son is finally old enough that he's doing his own thing and she can start doing her own thing again. And so that's what kept drawing me back. This woman who's like at once a part of her old way of life, but is also like thrilled by this new world that's on the dawn. And the movie even ends with Jamie's like saying, you know, I try to explain, because well, we're in spoilers now, we learn that Dorothea dies in 1999 after stockpiling quite a bit of gold in a bank because she's worried about Y2K. And
Great little detail.
Yeah. I was like, oh. But then again, you know, you listen to the stocks that she has, and that woman is loaded. It's like GE, IBM. It's like, holy shit. This woman is going to be rich for the rest of her life. And he says, you know, like years after she died, I like got married and had a family, which I did the math. Sure. I think that puts him at like late 30s for starting a family.
Yeah.
Which, I guess if these films are vaguely autobiographical, I don't know much about Mike Mills, but I mean, Ewan McGregor, I think, was like pushing 40 in Beginners. And, you know,
he did say this is very autobiographical.
Yeah. Because in Beginners, you know, Ewan McGregor says, like, I'm 40, I'm single again, and I'm like falling for this girl, and this is dumb. But yeah, I mean, it seems late in life, but we already have a movie dealing with that. But he says, like, I tried to explain to my children who their grandmother was, and like I never feel like I do a good job, or I can't remember his exact final words, but you know, it makes it clear that
he had a son when he was like 46, Mike Mills, with Miranda July of all people. That's who he's married to. Yeah.
Speaking of early 2000s independent cinema. So yeah, I mean, it's clear that because the movie ends on that level, this is like, it's supposed to be, I guess we're supposed to take from this her story and its way that it affected these other people. But I, you know, just that kind, like you said, Mike, it's hard to know if it's bad writing or if this is exactly the movie he wanted to make and he was fine with the shagginess of it. Sure. But I feel like ending on a line that so clearly pinpoints her as the thing we should be thinking about as the credits roll, it's a little hard to accept then the time spent with, you know, Elle Fanning and her mother and her sister and all of her actions.
She gets the final line, but that ending does wrap up everybody's story. Like, yeah. It is a wrap up.
I also think of from like the different, like if it was the reverse perspective where these people just kind of pop in and you don't get any backstory, I feel like you might have even yearned for that. So I think by just even attempting to go into it, I think it does make this movie, what it costs, I think like $7 million. And there's like this epic feel to it that no other film of that budget that I can think of really has.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a good thing. It's just, I think it's a little strange because, you know, in Beginners, we sort of just had this one person. We had Ewan McGregor doing his little voiceover, which kind of gets, you know, a remix here with everyone doing it. And I think that as great as that is in terms of, you know, the epicness of the scope we're talking about, it makes it harder to feel the sense of loss that you might otherwise get because, you know, at some point, Elle Fanning moves away to New York, I think. And, you know, she says, like, I like lost touch with Dorothea and Jamie. But then she tells us, you know, she moves to Paris and like her and her husband decide not to have children. And so it's hard to emotionally connect with someone like Jamie who cared for her so much and like, you know, it'd be interesting if he were to say, like, you know, she moved away and we lost touch and I have literally no idea what happened to her, because that would kind of put you in his mind and you'd either see that it affected him or maybe conversely it didn't affect him at all. And this was where he learned that, like, love is in fact fleeting, but you come back from it no matter how much it hurts. But instead we learn everything. So we don't have any questions, so we can't understand perhaps what the rest of his life was like until he found the woman that he eventually had children with.
You know, this is so interesting to me that this was your takeaway in that sense. Cause like I honestly leaving that, my whole thing was like, it's again, like, you know, zagging when it could have taken a more traditional route, even to the end, like exactly that thing you were talking about in the sense that like, he completely lost touch with Elle Fanning's character. Like those things are all, there's just no neatness. And there's a lot of neatness in previous Mike Mills films. And like, there's so much neatness in movies in general. So it's just, I guess I'm just reacting. It's just really interesting that this was the thing that disconnected you when this is the thing where I said, this is so much better than what a neater story would have given me specifically.
I agree to a point, but like I said, I guess I just, the fact that we still learned what happened is a little weird. It's like, okay. So Stand By Me ends.
Okay.
Richard Dreyfuss, like summing up everyone else. And there's a point where he says, like, one of his friends really got into, like, the 60s or the 70s and was never heard from again.
Sure.
And that's, like, an interesting, great line and kind of lets you know, like, how life goes sometimes. And then in this movie, you have that, but then you have that person chime in and say, I followed the dead around for a while and then, like, started managing a carpet shop. It's harder for me to, I mean, like I said, I like it. I don't mind it, but I think that it disconnects just a tad because by having this godlike omnipotent view, you're not really empathizing. You're just understanding. Does that make sense? What I just said?
Not really, but I'm not sure whether it's how you described it or whether I'm just unwilling to see your perspective.
I think it would be different if, like, for example, if everything was, like you said, through perhaps Jamie's eyes, but because it from the start we're so, you know, jumping around with different, you know, there's not one person in every scene. It, you know, there's this you know, we get a little glimpse of everyone, that that godlike view works with the story. But if it was like, if the entire film was through Jamie's eyes and he was in every scene, and then at the end we got that, I think it would be a little weird. But I think because how it's laid out from the very start, I think it fits the story.
I mean, it definitely fits the story. I'm just saying that might be why I disconnect in general from the movie. Like, I think that that may be where my trepidation about giving this, like, all of my love as I did to beginners may stem from that choice, which is a choice which is done well, but I just don't know if I'm the type of person who will appreciate that in the way that obviously you or Mike did.
I will say it's definitely, you know, it's between Jamie and Dorothea, you know, Annette Bening and Lucas Jade Zuman. I think it's their character. You know, the line, I think my favorite line in the movie is, you know, when she says, you know, you get to see him out in the world as a person.
Yeah.
You know, I never will. And that's what, you know, really, you know, touched me too, you know, in terms of like thinking about my relationship with my mom. Like, there's this moment, you know, when you're 18 and you will never have the same relationship, you know, you have again with your parent. I don't know. Did that affect you at all, Brian?
Yeah, no. I mean, it
did. Are you heartless?
Well, because I've got a kid now.
Sure.
So things like that. Like, we talked about this, I think, on one of the roundtables that we recorded about crying in the movies, because that was the one where one of them got corrupted. So if I'm referring to something that didn't happen, I apologize. We talked about how, like, I didn't feel any great awakening from a narrative understanding standpoint when I had a baby, because I'd always kind of gotten that idea in an abstract. And I still get it in the abstract, but now I can apply it to my very real reality. And so I was thinking about that, like, you know, no matter how quote unquote cool I am, no matter how open of an understanding I have with my daughter, you know, odds are she's not going to act around other people the way she acts around me, because I'm still her dad and I still have the power to ground her. So yeah, it's going to be weird having to come to terms with that. But then, you know, I look at my own reality and I no longer censor myself around my parents. They pretty much get me full bore whenever we're around each other. So it's interesting. It's an interesting idea to have to come to terms with. And I think it's nice how Abby hands her that picture of him looking just unhinged in happiness. And it's an interesting concept. It's an interesting idea. I think it's also interesting to think about how that changes now that we have social media, and children now have like less of a sense of what privacy is, or compartmentalizing. So yes, to answer your question, yes, I was affected by that, and I found it an interesting idea. like I keep saying, there's nothing in this movie that feels like a failure. There's nothing in this movie that feels like it was done unwell. I think that it's just coming down to my reaction to the choices made and whether or not I accept them, which in certain cases I don't. But I don't think that that's a problem with the movie. I think that that's just me and how I'm interfacing with the movie.
That's fair.
Yeah. This isn't like, to go back to last week, Personal Shopper, where I felt that like they had three too many endings and I wasn't clear on what the stakes were at a certain point. Like, this movie has a very clear picture, has a number of well-developed, interesting, fleshed-out characters. And I enjoyed it. I didn't sit there the entire time going, what the hell am I doing here, like I did with Queen of Earth. You know, there's not a fault to be found in this movie the way that it is. I'm just kind of curious as to whether or not I could have been made to care about the story more or understand what it was doing more if it had been presented in a different way. But I don't, that's not what they wanted to do. That's not what Mike Mills wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I just have to accept that. You know, this wasn't like butchered in the edit. It wasn't, you know, producers didn't screw with it. There wasn't a script doctor who came in. Like, this is the full picture that they wanted to give me. And I appreciate it and I liked it to a point, but I just don't think that it's specifically designed for the tastes of Brian J. Rowan.
This is, to say as well, this is like exactly the movie that is like what I'm going through right now, in the sense of the reversal of what you were talking about specifically, Brian, which is not only parents being able to see their children, but also teens being able to see their parents as not just their parents, but actual people, people with, anxieties about things like you were talking about the permissiveness of her. But like that also doesn't really get at the fact that like every time he's out doing something, she's also like deeply uncomfortable with it, but she also thinks he should find his truth or something. Like she doesn't obviously love that he is, you know, going to punk shows or drinking with Abby's character. In fact, she talks about like, am I doing this? I think she has a conversation with Billy Crudup's character. Like, am I doing this totally wrong? Am I just going to fuck him up beyond repair? So there's just like, in the same way this isn't for you, this is 100% for me at this exact moment.
Well, that's
in
that's
my
great.
Life.
That's what, yeah. That's what we go to movies to find. I think that the thing that kind of struck me the most was how, you know, she's got this woman, Abby, who's like trying to teach him to be like sensitive and feminist, but his mother is like, I don't feel like men can feel comfortable being who they are anymore. And so like, she's hoping that they're going to teach him to be like a man. And instead Abby is like doing this other thing, like this new man type thing. And it's like not entirely what the mother wanted. Like, you know, teach him about certain things, but my God, like don't have my, again, is he like 16 or something?
He's 15.
Don't have my 15-year-old son like get in a fight with someone because when a guy tells him a sex story, he starts talking about clitoral stimulation. You know? It's weird. It's weird that she would think that Abby would be a good arbiter of like helping her son to grow into a man. I think that it would also be weird if she thought that was good about literally anyone in this movie, but I guess that's just who she's got.
Abby and Julie.
Yeah. Well, I was gonna walk through Julie and then William, and I was like, yeah, let's just say everyone. Everyone in this movie is not great. And I think that's one of the points it's making. You kind of have to become your own person. But I thought it was interesting how Dorothea was like, you know, men used to be one thing and now they're not, and there's like this line they have to walk. It's kind of, you know, this question of masculinity and what it is that gets bandied around usually as a joke on the internet, but is pretty true. And it was interesting to see kind of the beginning of that here, and this poor kid struggling with it and getting the shit beaten out of him.
You're sounding dangerously close to Anne Hathaway in The Intern right now, Brian.
I did not see that.
It's good, but you're very close to what she says.
What did she say in the Intern?
It just sounds like she's like, men used to be able to, that they used to dress up and they used to have facial hair. And it's just like this weird pan for like the past of masculinity. And it gives me hives every time I think about it.
I mean, I'm not about to go there, though. If we could bring hats back, I'd be fine with it. Okay. Well, now let's just talk for 20 minutes about how we should bring hats back.
I do have to say that because I didn't mention my favorite scene in the film is which you mentioned briefly, but Billy Crudup explaining the end of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh my God,
just the way he does
best.
It, I was like cracking up so hard.
Yeah, that scene was so awkward, and then him just saying like the end of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Like his eyes wide and he's like not certain if he should be doing it, but he's gonna do it.
Yeah, but then he slowly just says it. It's hilarious.
It's great. Yeah. I love Billy Crudup. He's a great guy. No, I'm not like doing a peon to old masculinity. I think it is an interesting question that like doesn't really get brought up enough, because there's all this conversation of, you know, obviously William's reading a lot of things about women and how women should be treated and what women are. He, in one of the most cringingly awkward scenes, reads something to his mother as though trying to explain herself to herself.
Sure.
And she bites back against that. But, you know, it's a weird situation.
That's probably my favorite scene.
Yeah, I have many. I like all the scenes that you've mentioned are great. You know, I have a lot of favorite scenes in this movie, but I can't. I like as a whole. I just don't see them gelling together quite as well as they did in Beginners. But again, because this is a very different movie. I can't remember what I was trying to talk about. So
hats.
if we could bring back the wide brim fedora, I think that would be great.
I think that's now already I back see to the Brooklyn, intern. Isn't it?
No, that's the Trilby has really made a comeback, which is a shame because it's not.
I don't know what that means.
Anyway, so
the intern's good.
Except for that.
I will stand behind that.
Except for yeah, Beyond's like old school masculinity.
I like Nancy Myers a lot, though. Well, we could talk about Nancy Myers if you guys want to. But
that'll be our next roundtable discussion. The films of Nancy Myers. That was the one with De Niro, right? And he's like retired, but he takes an internship.
Yep.
I think there's something to be said about the fact that, like, moving away from old school concepts of what masculinity was, instead of filling it with something new, we've kind of just like let guys stay teenagers.
I don't know what you mean there.
I don't know. I'll have to, cause like when I think about like men of my father's generation, there was like a dividing line, and now it's like, I look at my friends and I'm like, man, we really haven't come much further than when we were 19 or 20. We're just making more money and like play acting at the concept of adulthood without any real like conversation about what it means. You know, like when I ask friends of mine, like, what do you think? Like, your job is like, what are we doing? Like, what is happening now? It's funny because I have so many who are like, you know, I go to work and then on the weekends I like get drunk and then I go to work again. And it's like, okay, well that was like, you know, college, but like, are you doing anything else? And it's like, no, I'm still renting. I'm still eating most of my meals out. And, I'm still like searching for my next hookup on Tinder, and we're, you know, pushing 30 now. And it's like, okay, but like at some point, like, shouldn't we like try to create a life for ourselves that we then like have children and all this other stuff? And they're like, nah.
And so I think it's kind of a misnomer, though, that like past generations were diving into this, like, you know, with a plum or something. Like they felt like that was, there was no other choice. Like, I don't know. I get.
Well, yeah, obviously, like...
I don't know. I don't think it's a fair parallel, and, like...
Well, it's an unfair parallel for a number of reasons. First of all, like, we... And this is something that actually they said in Beginners, was that, like, you know, the comforts and benefits of modern life give us time to, like, feel... In that case, it was a sadness that our parents never had time for. But really, we have... more leisure time, and we can do more things because more things are taken care of, which is good. And I think that one of the things that Mike Mills, both of his films that I've seen, this and Beginners, are
Thumbsucker.
I have not seen Thumbsucker. But what these two films are great at is showing that generational divide, showing how you can't really look to the past for what you're supposed to do now because they weren't dealing with the same things. You know, In Beginners, Christopher Plummer's character, when he was a young man, had to, you know, meet in private, you know, to have any sort of homosexual relationship, and had to worry about getting rousted by the cops. And now he can go to a club and get into house music and have a gay book club and a gay Bible study. And so even for his own life, he can't look back on his own life to know what he's doing. Just as now with Dorothea trying to raise Jamie, you know, she can't look back at her own childhood because, as they said, you know, in that time, you know, the community helped raise children, and she's trying to do that now, but community doesn't mean the same thing anymore because values are fracturing off into like splinter groups, and so there's no real community value beyond tolerance and acceptance. But how does that help to shape a young man moving forward in the world, you know, it doesn't. And he's just got to feel out what works for him and what he's comfortable with and what he likes. And whether that's the Talking Heads versus Black Flag or, you know, I guess at that point they were second or third wave feminism and all these other things. It's an interesting concept and an interesting look at generational dynamics that you don't really usually get in a film without it being super adversarial. But in Mike Mills films, it's really just the way of the world.
That sums it up pretty well.
Yeah, that was great, Brian.
Yeah, literally as I was saying that, I thought to myself, well, I think this movie just went up a star in my mind. I am willing to let this end there before I say something to ruin my moment of clarity. Does anyone else
have
any...
And that's why we need hats.
God damn it. Seriously, like, I bought a hat once and, like, tried to make it a thing, and people were just like, why are you wearing a hat?
Yep.
Yeah. That's why noir is my favorite genre, because everyone's in fedoras. Anyway, let's move on. Any final thoughts on 20th Century Women before we get out of here?
Yeah, I would just say go see it. I do think we talked about it a little bit at the beginning, but the kind of release strategy for it didn't make it seem like it got lost in the shuffle. Like it only premiered at New York Film Festival, like, initially, and then was released like on Christmas Day when there was like 20 other releases, and then so I think it deserved more acclaim for sure.
Yeah,
I would agree.
I definitely agree.
Also, a really good soundtrack. Which
oh, super good.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a great ending song, like a credit song.
Yeah, actually, I was going to turn this off, and then I like just listened to that whole song. I was like, nope, I'm sticking with this. So that is all of our thoughts on 20th Century Women. It is out now on VOD. You can rent it for like $4.99 for the HD and version on Amazon.
I also have the Blu-ray, and it has a great Mike Mills commentary. So,
oh, snap. Having talked about it now, I may have to buy this on Blu-ray. I already own Beginners, so that's good. Let's move on. As I said previously, we are brought to you today by Mubi. For your free 30-day trial of Mubi, go to mubi.com/filmstage. There are a number of great films coming to Mubi. We talked earlier about a couple. Their names escape me at the moment. But again, the one thing I really want to plug, because it's funny, Netflix made such a huge deal about how you can download certain things from us now to watch on the go, and that is something that Mubi has offered pretty much since the beginning, and it truly is a lifesaver for your introverted, what's that word for someone who hates everyone?
Apathetic?
No, apathy means that you don't really care about people.
Yeah.
Somebody.
Misanthrope.
Yeah,
I am
there we
misanthrope.
Go.
And so being able to take a movie with me on the go means that my contact with humanity gets to stay at a nice, nice minimum. So go to mubi.com/filmstage. You can have 30 days on us to try out Mubi, where again, you can download movies to feed your misanthropy and introversion.
I think we found the tagline, Mubi for misanthropes everywhere.
Mubi, feed your misanthropy and introversion on the go. And again, that's mubi.com/filmstage. You know what's funny? I still think about, like, perhaps maybe in like the first 10 episodes, there was a moment where Danny King was talking about a film that he saw on Mubi, but he called it like Mubi.
And yeah, I remember that.
He said it with such certainty, and there was just this pause, and then Nick Newman and I both came down on him. That was good times. That was 235 episodes ago. We're all going to die someday. Anyway, with that comforting thought in mind, let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found between now and next week. What are we talking about next week?
Lost City of Z?
That's probably too limited. It's only in New York and LA, but then it's nationwide the next week.
Oh,
Fate of the Furious, guys.
Oh, yes.
Oh.
The Fate of the Furious. I am looking
Which
forward
is nearly
to that
3 hours.
That's fine. That is
Bill's gonna have a cow.
The best news that I heard this week was the Fate of the Furious screenwriter saying what Fast and Furious fans have been waiting to hear, that he has space. No problem taking them into space.
Yeah.
Yes. This space.
Jordan, are you not a fan of the Fast series?
I think it reached its peak with Fast Five and has kind of gone downhill since. But I will say that actually initial runtime is incorrect. It's only 2 hours and 16 minutes. So, so that's something.
All right. Well, next week
we'll straight out of Compton director, I believe as well, isn't it?
Yeah, F. Gary Gray. Yep.
Yeah.
Sweet. All right. Anyway, let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found between now and next week. Jordan Raup.
Yes, on the film stage and on Twitter at JP Raup.
All right. Michael Snydell. I almost called you Michael.
You can find me on Twitter at @Snydell, where I will be rebelling against the strictures of modern society, just like the kid in 20th Century Women. And, my writing on the film stage and Facebook.
All right. And you can find me online at twitter.com/BrianJRowan. You can find me on Letterboxd at the same. I have had a lot of free time recently, so I've been watching some of the most random shit on Netflix.
I saw Deja Vu the other night.
Yeah, I watched Deja Vu. I watched Snake Eyes. I rewatched Matchstick Men. I finally saw Paddington, a delightful movie.
That's good. That's
Paddington
good
is
movie.
Great. Anyway, that's on Netflix. So check out Paddington on Netflix. I am not in it, but I fully endorse it. thefilmstage.com. And you can find all these episodes on iTunes and thefilmstage.com. And join us next week when we're going to talk The Fate of the Furious. Places to park. Find the factories and buildings. Restaurants and bars. For later.